Welcome to Queer Devotions from Rainbow Faith and Freedom. I'm Bridget Palou-Fry. Welcome back. We are very excited to put out another episode, this time with Hannah Maitland, a York University PhD student, who actually has a very exciting behind-the-scenes role for this podcast in helping us produce our special series, Resisting the Script, 25-plus Years of Queer Activism. But Hannah, in her own right today, speaking from her position as a scholar and activist, is sharing learnings from workshops that she co-led at York University called Queer Pedagogies, and presents so many actionable steps to really have better conversations, especially when these conversations are about identity and can often draw pretty strong emotions. So I learned a lot listening to Hannah's perspective, and I really hope you enjoy this episode. So welcome to the podcast today, Hannah. How are you doing?
Happy to be here. I'm great. How are you doing?
Great. I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us. So we're talking today about queer pedagogies. And for those who don't know or are just learning to know, what is a queer pedagogy? What does that actually mean?
Yeah, so it's sort of two things. So we have queer pedagogies, the idea, and queer pedagogies, you know, just to be right to the point, is what we named a workshop series. So the general sense, queer pedagogies is just developing an exploration into learning and teaching that is non-normative, that holds space for queerness, not just in terms of sort of sexuality and gender identity, but really critically considering, well, who are we as teachers and who are we teaching and learning with, holding space for this difference and ambiguity, and really disrupting the idea of having this set learning goal that students need to adhere to, hitting these specific benchmarks. So having this space for teaching in a way that has all these different possibilities, even when they're ambiguous or uncomfortable or might lead to these, you know, bigger question marks than we start with. Queer Pedagogies, the workshop series, was started by my friend and colleague, Morgan Bim. She's a couple years ahead of me in the gender studies program here at York. And so it started as a reading group where we met, I think, once or twice a month, just a few grad students in the department to talk about our experiences in as teaching assistants, what we wanted to talk about, what we felt we couldn't talk about or didn't have the support to engage with. And then this expanded into a sort of broader workshop series where people from all over liberal arts and professional studies would come and talk about these things with us. So those are sort of the two streams of what queer pedagogies means.
Thanks for walking us through that. And so you mentioned earlier on, this was a smaller workshop series with fellow grad students that expanded. What did you notice in terms of how people engage with these series? What did it seem that people really felt they were missing in their educational practices?
Yeah, I mean, I think what people were really wanting was some TA training that, there isn't a ton of formalized TA training available. You really have to go and find it for yourself. There's no sort of, all right, you've become a teaching assistant, so now you need to go here and learn this and do this in exact order. It's sort of, well, you have a bachelor's degree by now, so go ahead and teach. So people were really wanting not just instruction, but also instruction that came from their peers. So not just to go to a learning center and have sort of a professional say, you know, here are the rules and here are some resources. As much as that's helpful, what we found was people really wanted to talk to other people who were teaching assistants, especially because that gave more space, it felt like, to admit, oh, I think I kind of messed this up, or this isn't going well. And it's easier to say that to a peer than someone who you might feel like, oh, are you going to, you know, report me or tell me I'm doing things wrong? So people wanted both instruction, but what we found people were really looking for was support in what they were doing in their sort of teaching and TA practices.
Just taking us to that workshop series, where did you begin with folks when describing this practice? What were some of the first teachings that you brought people through?
Yeah, by the time we sort of moved to the stage last year where we had really opened things up beyond just one department, we did sort of four and a half. We had five workshops planned. The last one sort of was lost to COVID, unfortunately, as so many things were. But our first workshop was run with the Queer Graduate Caucus at York. So it was just an open, let's talk about queer pedagogies in general. So we started out with, you know, what does queerness mean to you? What does a queer pedagogy look like? So we would really start with asking people, you know, what do they want? What are they looking for? What is of interest to them? And that first workshop was quite successful. People really enjoyed it. So then our secondary series were a bit more specific. So we had one that was about leading discussions and how to navigate disclosures. So when students bring up things in the classroom where they've disclosed maybe a traumatic experience and how to sort of work through that and navigate that. We had one about sort of institutional barriers and opportunities. So how to actually navigate things around the university. Our last workshop was Queering Beyond Queer, we called it. So we had some of our colleagues come in and talk about ability and disability in pedagogy. One of Morgan's colleagues talked about fat studies and sort of really the physical body in the classroom, which was really cool. So we started out in this very general, what is queer and queerness? And then for each of these workshops, we tried to get a little more specific with this combination of, you know, just discussing things that maybe you haven't had the opportunity to ever really talk about or discuss before with a couple, you know, hard skills. So we'd usually do like little scenes maybe, or things like, oh, a student has submitted a paper that's, you know, has some really transphobic sort of thoughts and feelings in it. How do you maybe navigate that with the student?
And very curious, what would that look like? I mean, what would your advice be to someone who would be navigating that with a student?
I mean, it's one of those back and forth difficulties of, you want to engage with that student in a way that's non-accusatory, because a lot of us, even though we moved beyond the department, most of the people coming to our workshops were still coming out of women's studies, sexuality studies. So usually students have been explicitly asked, you know, to work with transness. And sometimes they would try to express something that was, you know, affirming or just work through the readings and would sort of, you know, write something that was a bit often sort of odd, like, where exactly is this coming from? Did you really mean to say this? What direction are you going here? So how to work through, you know, something that might be to you feel quite, you know, violent, and work through that in a non-accusatory way of, what have you said here? What are the implications of this? Why have you come to this conclusion? Because if you have work submitted, you might be seeing a final product of a thought process that might not be what you expect. You don't necessarily know what led a student to put this on a page and give it to you. And of course, the complexity of navigating, why has this happened, with how do I assign a grade to this? How can I reach out and get support from the professor? And taking care of ourselves, because sometimes if students submit sort of strange or unpleasant or aggressive stuff to us, we're implicated in it. I once received a very homophobic paper, and I was like, oh, this is about me. I'm the kind of person that you don't like. So working through this is very much working through some of my own feelings in that moment. So that was another reason we wanted this workshop space, for people to talk about their very personal feelings about how students or subject matter made them feel, and having the space to take care of themselves and each other.
So part of it is asking questions, trying to get more information from a person who perhaps you don't understand their motives for why they're saying those things, but then also having care for oneself. Because of course, reading those comments can be quite tough.
Yeah. And so sometimes that exploratory work doesn't need to fall on you. You can pass it along to someone else if that, you know, labor of sort of exploring where exactly this is coming from, you can maybe share that with someone else or move that up to a professor if you're feeling made sort of vulnerable by it. And that's okay. You're not reneging your responsibility by saying, this is a bit, you know, I'm not really liking how I'm implicated in what this student has said or done, and I need some support here.
And so kind of learning the greater context for these workshops and understanding how they were working for you and your colleagues, how did you see the practice and conversation around queer pedagogies? How did that enable you to have different conversations? What other conversations did you see result from that? And later on, I want to get to sort of how we put into practice queer pedagogies in the faith and crisis context.
For sure. So probably the biggest thing we noticed was that people really wanted to have complicated conversations in their classrooms, that this had already happened before, and that they wanted their classrooms to be productive spaces to really talk about things that could be quite complex, be that sexuality and gender or race, talking about one's place in the university, like what room do we have to really critique the system we're participating in right now? And people really want to have these conversations, but don't necessarily know how or feel like if they, you know, maybe go forth with something, what are the lasting impacts? Because, some more than others, but all classrooms are communities. So what people really wanted to navigate was, how do I have either have an interesting conversation and, you know, keep it going, or how do I have a bad day and recover and sort of maintain the classroom community that people feel, you know, that this is a workable space for them, even if there might have been an argument or something sort of, you know, unpleasant said in a classroom setting.
Mm. Yeah, so the second part is, what does a queer pedagogy look like when we are describing faith, spirituality, and gender and sexual difference? That is quite a big question. But how would you say the approach that you're describing can sort of help us have these conversations? And what are some practical tools that you would sort of signal for folks?
Right. So one is that sort of our starting point with queer pedagogy is this idea of queerness, is that being queer is being non-normative, is a way of being where you don't necessarily have all the answers or follow all the rules as they've been sort of established for a long time. And I think sort of from my own experience of, you know, navigating or, you know, sort of encountering conversations about queerness in faith-based spaces, is that there can be an assumption that, well, queerness is an issue that happens outside of our worship community or our faith community. You know, we're talking about this in a really intellectual, theoretical way. And what we were trying to do is make space for the understanding that no matter what we talk about in the classroom, someone in our midst, in real life, right in front of us, has experienced this, that these things are very real for real people who are with us, who are in our communities. So one thing we talked about a lot was having students sort of recognize and having ourselves recognize that we're always talking about someone who's in the room with us. It's not just, oh, there are queer people outside of our faith community and we need to talk about what happens if they show up. It's no, queer people are already here. They're already with us and always have been.
Mm. So visualizing or even making an active effort to acknowledge the person in the room, maybe, and you mentioned disclosure for people who do not necessarily feel safe to disclose. Is it sort of recognizing that there may be someone who is, I guess my question is how does disclosure work then in that setting where you're trying to be responsive to, people's comfort levels.
Right. And of course, that's very difficult because you want people to have this understanding that queer people are real, they're within worship communities, without necessarily outing someone or making them make themselves visible if they don't want to be or don't feel ready to be yet. And if people disclose things, you know, perhaps, you know, spontaneously, or they're really ready to disclose, is what does that ongoing support look like? Because these oftentimes aren't just, you know, here's a workshop with a bunch of strangers and then we disperse. A lot of the times when these conversations happen in worship communities, it's with, you know, a congregation. Maybe these are people you have grown up with your entire life. And so what does that ongoing care of checking in with people, following up later, look like? We talked about that a lot in the sort of classroom setting of what's maybe a tactful way to, if someone's maybe looking like they're having a hard day or said something that, you know, looks like it took a lot of energy and emotion on their part, is just in a non-invasive way, checking in and saying, how are you doing? How can I support this a little bit further? How are you feeling after the fact, after this has happened?
Hmm.
sometimes, you know, there's something, just a minor discomfort. Sometimes there's a big blowout with people, but they're mm-hmm. usually in your midst. It's not like this stranger has arrived, said something, and left. You keep going, be it for the semester or for, you know, the rest of your faith life together. But what if this is your parish family where this is happening?
And I guess I'm thinking about how people come to these conversations and the fear of getting things wrong. How did you see that showing up in your conversations in the workshops, the fear of getting things wrong? And how do people learn from things they've said or done and kind of account for that and move on and do better the next time?
Yeah, that was often a big part of our conversations. And in the classroom setting, there's the two-tier, you know, have I done something wrong in the sense of, am I going to get in trouble now? Is, you know, the professor going to be displeased with me or the department? And sort of, I think the bigger question of what if I hurt someone, which, you know, no one in these workshops wants to do. Everyone who came was really passionate about teaching as being transformative, that it was something that can really be a tool for social justice. And so they want, you know, life to get better for people, not to hurt people. And I think that is very much often the case when these conversations start out in faith-based communities of just wanting the best for everyone. And yeah, I think a lot of people do, you know, misunderstand each other and don't necessarily recognize when something is a critique and when something is an attack, or when something is an exploratory question and when something is, you know, an accusation. And so it is very difficult. Like, we're talking about this because it's difficult conversations, and they are difficult conversations. Something that I think we kind of have to really reckon with is that there's no perfect roadmap for getting this done, that we can put sort of procedures, policy, best practices in place for trying our best and for holding always in the center of our conversations that we are here to support each other, that we want to do good and do right by each other. But there are always going to be those moments where there are misunderstandings, or people use language that is hurtful, even when they don't realize it, or feel like that they, you know, have the right to exclude people from their communities. And so I think it's worth acknowledging that these are always going to be difficult conversations, and we can have them while taking care of each other, but that we aren't going to be perfect every time, and that's okay.
Absolutely. And I wonder too, then on the contrary, how this works when there are sort of red lines or things that are, I guess, harder to account for when people have crossed sort of a very specific clear line in terms of respect for one another. How do you kind of negotiate that moment when something seems kind of beyond the pale of what can be forgiven?
Yeah, and we talked about that a lot, in that, you know, we're trying our best for the classroom to be a learning environment for everyone, but there can come a point where someone is told, maybe not forever, but in the midst of this moment, this conversation, this class, sometimes people need to leave, that what you are doing is hurting someone and this just needs to stop right now. And maybe that needs a follow-up with someone, you know, not just the person who has been hurt, but the person who has done the hurting, to unpack, you know, why did this happen? Or I need you to recognize that this is unacceptable, that, you know, you playing devil's advocate in this moment was not appropriate. This was not an intellectual exercise. You were hurting the people around you in what you've said, even if you didn't mean to. And that, I think we did sort of come to this conclusion throughout these workshops, that as much as we wanted every conversation to be a conversation and reach a kind of satisfying conclusion, that there is space to just stop things sometimes, to say, you know what, this isn't working right now. We're not, you know, looking after each other. This has become sort of a harmful conflict, not a productive sort of discussion. So we got to go, and we can try again later, because just because something's gone poorly once doesn't mean it's going to go poorly every time. But there's really no shame in just saying, we got to pull the plug on this one, and we're going to follow up later.
And you mentioned sometimes there are people who play the devil's advocate, and see it more so as an intellectual exercise rather than something that is very much connected to the real world. And how do you, and you mentioned earlier, really, really connecting that, saying, you know, these people are already in this space. How else did you make that argument for the very real implications that these discussions can have, and how they are not just about the intellectual, but very much about people in a community with each other?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that we found is that, you know, you make that known right up front. It's not like you've, you know, been teasing out an intellectual discussion for weeks, and then you say, by the way, real people are real. Like, that is your opener to say, we're here to talk about real human beings who are already with us. And that part of priming the conversation is saying, this is real. This is real. This is right now. This is both past and the future. We're in it. And so to not wait to bring up the emotional aspect of things, even if we're doing something like, you know, scriptural interpretation or working through sort of church law or policy or what have you, is that really prioritizing the human, the real, the emotional, the everyday life right up front in these conversations was something we sort of agreed on as being really important. And another thing that we found is that something that you can do when we're talking about communities that we might not necessarily have our own personal experience with is that, is there maybe a text we can refer to? We found a lot that people have just described experiences of feeling stuck in a discussion and having sort of the most productive way to diffuse things, maybe reroute, is to say, well, what did our reading for today say? Or last week we read an article and it said this. How can we maybe bring that into this conversation? So having things be about, you know, maybe having a text or something to centralize and orient your discussion, so that's not just about, you know, one individual anecdote or experience that now we're hyper-focusing on, but maybe talking about something that's real, but maybe one step away from our own sort of community. So it's not just about, all right, we're really talking about you right now, Susan, but about something where we might have that ability to say this is real, but have it be maybe one step removed.
Yeah. So, okay. So yeah, thank you for describing that. And that, of course, that framework is super crucial. And I guess I'm wondering, in terms of recommendations for spiritual leaders, religious leaders, or leaders in a community who are looking to hold these conversations and bring this to a parish community or your congregation or whatever it is, what are some tips that you would give to them as they are looking to host a conversation about faith and queer identities?
Yeah, I mean, to begin, if you already want to hold that space, that's already a great step. Because I think a lot of communities are very much of the opinion that, well, if we just don't talk about this, it'll reach a natural conclusion somehow. So by already desiring to hold space, that's already really an excellent step of saying, of it, you know, acknowledging that this is going to be work. So we're holding the space together so we can work through something together, to acknowledge that this is going to take some, you know, labor and some energy on the part of the people that we're working with, on the part of this community, that it's work that needs to be done. It's not something that we can just let, you know, run its course while we sit here. And I think another thing is that if you're sort of the leader in a faith community, that people are going to look to you for maybe a final answer, maybe a final direction. And that might not be a role that you necessarily want to have the final say. We talked about that a lot where, you know, as a teaching assistant, you don't necessarily want to have this overbearing presence where the people you're in your classroom feel like they're not actually being heard, that what they say doesn't matter because you get the final say. So you want this balance of, on one hand, you want the people you're talking to, who you're working with, your, you know, parishioners or what have you, to really feel listened to and heard. But if you're in the position of leader, you are going to have to do some moderation. Is that you are going to have to maybe say, all right, this is not going well, or maybe your behavior isn't really appropriate right now, or maybe we need to just hit pause on this conversation and have this later, or try again at a different time. Is that, and again, there's no sort of perfect resolution, but holding together this tension of people really want to be heard. So you need the space for them to say what they need and want to say. And that this is, you know, we need to have our duty of care for the people in our midst. So maybe that does mean hitting pause or redirecting a conversation and having that bit of authority, even if it feels like a bit of an imposition, to weigh that, all right, you know, we're trying our best here, but now we're starting to hurt each other. So maybe let's stop for now.
That's wonderful. It is. It's funny. We forget sometimes that we can hit pause and it doesn't mean the conversation's over. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's excellent. And I'm thinking too on the reverse about how to listen. So for those, I mean, you mentioned how leaders might show up in the space and provide the modeling and provide the direction for when things are challenging. But in terms of how we show up as listeners, how we show up, especially I'm thinking around differences in language or differences in generations where, you know, in the LGBTQ community, there are lots of different terms that we can use to describe ourselves, and those have changed throughout the years, of course. So how would you describe that process as a listener, especially with respect to differences in language?
So one thing that can be really useful for navigating language is just having things written down, is that people might feel lost in these different terms, how they've changed. So having a written glossary of terms, it doesn't have to be super intense or super complicated, can be really useful for people to have things to refer back to. And having something in writing might feel like less of an accusation when you have it written down to say, okay, we used to use this word for these people, but here's why that word is maybe considered derogatory. Here's why it doesn't really suit this community. And so now we use this word. Because I feel like when people use, you know, quote unquote, the wrong language, and you say, oh, that's really not a great word, or that's actually really offensive, sometimes people feel like you've made a personal accusation against them, that you're accusing them of intentionally doing harm when they're using the wrong words. And that can be really frustrating, because I feel like there are times when people can use that as a bit of an excuse, like, oh, you're just correcting my words, you're not actually listening to me, when the person doing the correcting is actually trying to have a bigger conversation about why this is offensive. And so because I think people can be quite sensitive about having their language corrected, having something written, doing a little pre-reading before we enter into conversation with each other in real time can be really useful to maybe sort of diffuse that before entering into conversation in person. And sort of setting up right in the beginning that we're going to, you know, question each other and correct each other. And that's going to be, okay, you know, we're not making accusations. We're just trying to learn together. And I think that's another reason that setting up sort of separate spaces of saying, all right, next week, we're going to do this. Come if you want to, can be a great way to set up a space where we know we're in learning mode right now, that this isn't just, you're making accusations at me at random. It's like, no, we're in the learning space now. We're going to unpack these little detailed things. It's not just this sort of sudden conversation that no one was prepared to have, which is why I think having separate space, you're prepared, maybe you did a little pre-reading, can be sort of a more productive space than maybe sort of addressing something spontaneously. And of course, sometimes you have to address things spontaneously. That's just the way things go. Sometimes it is a completely unrelated event where now we need to talk about why someone was hurt by the thing you said. That's just life. But having those sort of specific spaces, I think, can be really useful so that it doesn't feel like, how dare you accuse me of being transphobic out of nowhere? It's like, no, we're actually talking about the language that we all need to learn and deal with and unpack and think about.
I really like that, because coming to it both with these words have deep meaning and deep context, and putting that as reference, having the background reading to suggest that, and knowing that this is a space of learning, this is a place where we challenge each other in healthy, productive ways. That's great. Hannah, could you just walk us through a couple scenarios for these conversations?
Yeah, Morgan and I, that was sort of one of our big conversation starters for the workshops, is we'd start up, what are some common classroom behaviors and how do we navigate them? So one of the early ones we did is the student who is really happy to be there, really excited, but is perhaps taking up too much space to the point where they're dominating the conversation in ways that might be unhelpful, or where they're putting in an amount of work where you might become worried about them, that they're continually, you know, making themselves vulnerable or doing a ton of work to the point where you think, are you going to, you know, burn out right in front of me? You're really doing the most here. And it's great, but maybe this isn't sustainable. And I think that that can often happen in sort of faith-based or worship communities where you get, you know, the one out queer person who's really engaged, really excited. They want to hold the difficult conversations. They want to do the work. And on one hand, that's great. And they can be sort of an excellent starting point as the enthused person to hold the workshop on, you know, using affirming and encouraging queer language in our community. But understanding that this is going to be a long process. And if the excited person is, you know, a 20-year-old undergrad who has a lot going on in their life and they're super pumped right now, but maybe if you're, you know, a senior member of this community or the leader of this community saying, okay, this is great. I have this one person I can support, but they're going to need more support than just their moment of sort of excitement and enthusiasm. So are there maybe outside resources? Are there outside communities where we can embed this in maybe a supportive network of people? So you don't have one person who does all this work in a big flash of energy and then they burn out because it's hard and they're doing it alone. So how can we support, you know, someone who's trying to lead these conversations and have ongoing sort of support in this community so things are sustainable? I think sustainability was a really big point we had in our conversations where, you know, having hard conversations is hard. So it's very tempting to reach a point where we are tired, we are exhausted, we're harming ourselves by trying to, you know, do the best for others. And so things just sort of stop. And so how can we sort of navigate forming space where maybe we're doing this at intervals that are sustainable or where we're reaching out for support from others, both within and outside our community, so that this isn't so tiring that we do it once and can never do it again.
Yeah, that makes so much sense, is figuring out the sustainability. So these are not just one-off conversations, and identifying those people who are excited and want to participate and wanting to make sure, you know, that there are space for others to also participate or there's extra support.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's okay to start small as well. You can't stay small forever. I feel like there's often a temptation that, you know, if we sort of navigate the perimeter of the difficult conversation, we've done all the work. But at the same time, you know, if you dive right in and we have one night where we're going to discuss, you know, everything between queerness and Christianity right now, that can be really daunting and tiring. And so it's okay to start very small and sort of work your way up over a period of time.
That's excellent. Well, I'd really like to thank you for joining the podcast today, Hannah. I really enjoyed this conversation and learned a lot.
Yes, thank you for having me on. It's been great to have this conversation. I wish Morgan could be here with us. She was unavailable. But yeah, we're both really excited to talk about this. We had a great experience leading these workshops, and we think they have a lot of potential to do more things. And so thank you for the opportunity to talk about this in the context of faith communities. It's really unique for this project.
Now go have great conversations, everybody.
Exactly. Thank you.
So thanks to Hannah. Thank you for sharing all of that incredible wisdom with us. And we are very excited to share more information with you about the special series. So look for that soon. I'm going to be releasing a teaser with some really fun clips of queer elders speaking from decades and decades of experience. And it has been such an amazing privilege to work on that, on the series. So I'm very excited for you to listen. Okay, have a good rest of your day.